Haus 1. Wir machen Podcasts.
Das Interview in dieser Folge wurde auf Englisch geführt. Es gibt keine Übersetzung. Für die wichtigsten Ergebnisse schaltet einfach die kommende Wochendämmerung am 20.11. ein. Willkommen zu einer Bonusfolge der Wochendämmerung. Heute ein Gespräch mit Arzu Geybullajewa. Arzu ist eine aserbaidschanische Journalistin. Sie schreibt unter anderem für Al Jazeera, Foreign Policy, Global Voices und sie war in der BBC List of Top Women 2014. Sie setzt sich seit Jahren für eine friedliche Lösung des Konflikts in Bergkarabach ein. Nichtsdestotrotz bekam sie für ihre Zusammenarbeit mit der armenischen Zeitschrift Argos in den letzten Jahren vermehrt Drohungen, vor allem aus Aserbaidschan. Derzeit lebt Arzu unter anderem deswegen im Exil in Istanbul. Ich habe mit ihr im folgenden Interview über den Konflikt in Bergkarabach gesprochen, das im Englischen Nagorno-Karabach genannt wird. Sie erzählt von den Entwicklungen der letzten Jahre und Jahrzehnte und von der Aussicht auf Frieden. Da sie als politische Journalistin im vergangenen Jahr außerdem ein sehr spannendes Projekt namens Aserbaidschan Internet Watch ins Leben gerufen hat, habe ich die Gelegenheit genutzt und sie auch dazu ausgefragt. Wir haben uns am Montagnachmittag per Squadcast im Internet getroffen und das Interview fand auf Englisch statt. Eine Übersetzung gibt es nicht. Die wichtigsten Punkte bringe ich aber in die kommende Wochendämmerung mit. Let's have a quick talk about what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh. Well, we have a new situation now. Then there has happened a lot, so let's look at this maybe, and then what is this all about? What is the greater story behind all this?
Sure. Well, I guess today is an important day because it marks a week since a new ceasefire was signed that was brokered by Russia between the parties to the conflict. There are still many unknowns after the ceasefire, especially about the next steps, about the peace process, because this document that was signed a week ago is certainly not a peace agreement. It's just an agreement to stop the fighting. It has succeeded, unlike previous ceasefires that were signed throughout the last 6 weeks, to really stop the fighting and really de-escalate the situation to the point where Azerbaijani government, Azerbaijan, has won the contested territories that were under the question of the status prior to the conflict. And right now there is still much euphoria in Azerbaijan, celebrations marking the victorious day, as well as protests in Armenia, unhappy with the outcomes and Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan's signing of the agreement. So on one side, we're seeing protests. On the other side, we're seeing celebrations. But also, as sort of the ink is drying on the document that was signed a week ago, questions are now being asked about, as I mentioned earlier, about the future steps, about any specific plans on resettlement, on remining, demining of the areas that have been returned to Azerbaijan after the war, the return of the IDPs that were originally displaced as a result of the war in the 90s, as well as many other questions that are related to the future of the relations between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the role Russia is going to play. For instance, one of the things being discussed today is the decision that was sent to the Turkish parliament here requesting the positioning of Turkish peacekeeping forces in Nagorno-Karabakh. This is something that Russian government has been sort of denying since the signing of the agreement, very much highlighting that only the Russian peacekeeping forces are present physically on the ground and that Turkey's role will be minimal. So it's going to be interesting to watch the developments as they come in. Today, President Ilham Aliyev visited one of the villages of the returned cities in Fizuli, and that has been also very much applauded, and it's yet to be seen what other areas he's going to visit, and whether there will be further explanations, further announcements made by the government, especially in the context of killed Azerbaijani soldiers, because we're yet to find out how many soldiers have died in this war, and so on and so forth.
So that's a lot to do for the future. But absolutely, right now it really seems as if Azerbaijan has won and is the winner of this conflict, and Armenians have lost the war. I read in the newspaper in Germany today that they burned their houses down as a sign of defeat. But what also struck me a lot about this conflict is that, isn't it an Armenian majority living in this region, Nagorno-Karabakh? So the reality of most people there is they are Armenian, they wanted to be part of Armenia or be independent. And now the outcome of all this is, it seems to me, against the will of most people living there in the region.
You do touch upon very sensitive topics, as many would say at this point. I think it's really important to clarify that Nagorno-Karabakh was predominantly ethnic Armenian populated, but the 7 adjacent territories that were contested and that were occupied by the Armenian forces during the 90s were not Armenian populated. They were all Azerbaijani populated areas, and this is where we saw the massive exodus of Azerbaijani IDPs in the 90s. The city of Kelbajar that you mentioned, where we've been also seeing reports of local Armenian residents leaving behind burned homes and cut trees and cut off telephone lines and whatnot. I think it's important to note that this is a very sad reality of this war, the human cost and the human suffering on both ends, not just Armenian, but also Azerbaijani. If anything, many have said in the last couple of days, watching what's happening in Kelbajar, that, well, this is what happened exactly almost 30 years ago, when Azerbaijani people were forced to leave their homes behind in much worse conditions and with much less media attention, media coverage of what was going on. It is also important to note that Nagorno-Karabakh may have had a predominantly Armenian population, but there were cities like Shusha and Kelbajar where Azerbaijanis were a majority before the war in the 90s. And hence there is this forced removal of the residents. But I mean, if you ask me, I think one of the questions that pop in my head is, when this agreement was signed, this is what it was lacking. You know, it was looking at strategic decision making, you know, stalling, fighting, and positioning of the Russian peacekeeping forces, but it didn't contain any humanitarian language, any, you know, social, cultural language of what's going to happen to the people, not just the Armenians who live in those territories now and who are have been given time to leave, which was extended yesterday, I believe, but also the relocation and resettlement of Azerbaijani internally displaced people back to their homes, and how all of this is going to evolve. And this is something that I noted earlier in my opening remarks. So, I mean, we're all seeing what you're seeing with the news coverage of those territories. And it's really, yeah, it's hard to say what's going to be next and how to really describe this particular situation. Only that when the war started, a lot of analysts and journalists who've been on the side of de-escalation since the beginning of this war, you know, we kept on saying that this is a humanitarian crisis in itself. And it became clear in the first week that it was not going to stop anytime soon, and that there will be more human losses, putting aside the military fighting that was going on, but the civilian losses, the destruction of civilian locations and schools and hospitals and whatnot. So it's a tragedy. no matter what angle you look from, whether from the military aspect in terms of lost lives, from civilian aspect from lost lives. But it is, as you said, it's a victory for Azerbaijan in terms of its physical trophies that it has picked up from this war, including, most importantly, the return of the territories. And I think it's also important to note that there was a significant amount of observers in Azerbaijan who were actually surprised by the agreements because they envisioned that the army will go until the end, taking back all of Nagorno-Karabakh, which did not happen according to the agreement. And so there are different opinions and there are different interpretations of what's happening. But from my point of view, from where I stand and from what I've been watching, it's a humanitarian catastrophe. And it continues to be that way, regardless of who won and who lost this war. Because at the end of the day, many lives have been lost and much infrastructure has been destroyed in the duration of this war.
This seems like a call for justice, more or less, and the institutions for international justice or peacekeeping would usually be the United Nations. But as this is a conflict, as it seems to me, between, two countries that are, part of a bigger game, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that Russia and Turkey more or less decide what's happening there and what's not happening there. And it's not so much about the United Nations having any say in any future justice processes also.
I mean, that's an accurate description. From the start, it was clear that Azerbaijan was the stronger actor in this war, not only because of the investment that he has done over the years, the buildup, the military buildup that it has accomplished over the years, but also because of the support that it had received from Turkey, especially in the military equipment side and the drones that they've purchased that really gave an upper hand for the Azerbaijani military in securing victory in this war. And of course, it just involvement of these two actors, Turkey and Russia, especially judging from their involvement in the region, especially in war zones as Libya and Syria, really was concerning from the very start. And that's why it's also not surprising that Russia was the one who brokered the peace, and it insisted on the presence of Russian peacekeeping forces, which is another point of contestation in Azerbaijan, because now that the war is over, and sort of this, like, you know, celebratory sentiment is calming down, questions are being asked about why there are Russian peacekeeping forces on the ground, especially when, you know, one of the things that Azerbaijan sort of prided itself in was absence of Russian peacekeeping forces all this time on its territory. So it begs the question of, you know, how this was reached in terms of, like, political decision making and what's next, because clearly there is no reference to any other peacekeeping forces coming in, and including and especially, you know, UN peacekeeping forces. I mean, we're yet to see what's going to come out of this. I mean, they're saying, according to the agreement, that the Russian peacekeeping forces will be there for the next 5 years, and that the peace agreement is something that will be negotiated throughout the next 5 years. And if neither of the sides object, the Russian peacekeeping forces will remain there for another 5 years. And so I think both sides, it's really important for the two sides to come to an agreement in terms of the peace process, if there is a will to remove the Russian peacekeeping forces who are on the ground. But I think the influence will be there, especially given that it was Russia who brokered the recent agreement. And also the Turkish role is very interesting. Turkey's role is very interesting, especially as Turkish parliament will be making a decision on the presence of Turkish peacekeeping forces, if this is going to be achieved or not. It's been characterized as a proxy war, yet another proxy war between Turkey and Russia. But as an Azerbaijani, you know, this was a war between Armenia and Azerbaijan with the significant support of these two powerful actors who are craving for more presence and control in the region.
I have read, I think it was an economist, that it was a frozen conflict for so long because there was another third great power that had its hands in there, America, the USA, and that taking back that power in the region by Donald Trump, who has always said, no, I don't want to be involved in any conflicts over the world, is one of the reasons that this escalation happened this year. Is there any chance that by, let's say, a President Biden who is more interested in international relations, maybe, we don't know yet, that there could be a new role in the peacemaking process for Nagorno-Karabakh?
I think the term frozen conflict, or how Nagorno-Karabakh was described, the conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh was described, is not necessarily a correct way to describe this conflict, because yes, there was a ceasefire that was reached in 1994, but the conflict was never really frozen. I mean, there were violations of ceasefire, there were escalations. Most recent escalation was in April of 2016 with a four-day war, and yet again, Russia brokered an agreement between two sides to cease the fighting. Similarly, in July, there was another escalation, and I think this is why I always had like an issue with calling Nagorno-Karabakh a frozen conflict, because to me it never really felt like a frozen conflict in itself. As for the reason why it's been this way, I think US is not the only actor that we could talk about, in especially in terms of its disengagement in the region. I think EU is equally responsible for that term, or carrying that term, because at the very beginning of the war that started on September 27th, there was a lot of conversation around disengagement of the US and the EU, and the actors sort of, you know, pushing the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh on the sidelines, not just because Trump was the president or EU was having their own crises, but because of the failure of the OSCE Minsk group in particular, that was the main negotiator of peace, including with all the actors, not doing enough in terms of really trying to resolve this conflict. And sure, like if we look at the Minsk group co-chairs, we see US, we see France, we see Russia, you know, of all those actors, Russia was the most actively involved, because of its geographical proximity, but also of its historical relations between the two countries. But to blame US for its disengagement just because President Trump, well, is a President Trump, I think is not enough. There are many responsible actors in this war, and the fact that it's not been resolved earlier through diplomacy, and that is the Minsk group. It's also the actors, the main actors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, who throughout the years engaged in conversations that were not fruitful and that were not geared at bringing results, or at least this is what we're seeing now. I mean, if the war started and ended this way, it clearly is a sign that negotiations were futile. So, you know, whether it was possible to resolve this conflict peacefully in the last 26 years, I certainly do think that had there been more engagement, more concrete engagement and more demands and more negotiations taking place, I think it would have been possible to avoid this. Especially, you know, it's just been a political vortex with, you know, decisions disappearing, agreements disappearing, and just this absence of interest in resolving this conflict. I don't think there was necessarily this expectation that war will escalate to the point that it did this time, when, you know, looking at Western reaction in general. I don't think there was an understanding that once it escalates, it could last longer than 4 days, which is what we all saw in April 2016. And I don't think there was any sort of expectation that there will be so many losses and that a war could resolve a conflict that's been simmering in this region for so many years.
All right. Yeah, that's true. So now that I have you here, I have to ask you about your project, because you are Azerbaijanian journalist living in Istanbul, but you have this project. It's called Azerbaijan Internet Watch. And I'd like our listeners to learn about this project, because I think it's very important. What are you doing there?
It's basically a platform that monitors information control related news that take place in Azerbaijan. And by that, I mean anything that involves authoritarian use of authoritarian technology, surveillance, internet censorship, any kind of digital attacks against civil society representatives, whether it's, you know, hacking of accounts, phishing, DDoS attacks. It's basically a monitoring platform. And I started it last year in October 2019. It was basically an outcome of a project I was doing the year before that was looking at information controls in Azerbaijan with a fellowship that was granted to me through the Open Technology Fund. And as I was writing the research, as I was doing it, it really occurred to me that it would be great to make this long-term and not just a one-time report. And I was lucky and grateful for the OTF grant that was originally granted to me for fulfilling this project. And yeah, I mean, I work with several partners in this project, partners who are much better in understanding the language of attacks and surveillance technology that is being used. So they help with identifying the attackers. They help in analyzing the type of attack, the type of technology that is being used in targeting activists online. And we also do tests in Azerbaijan for your listeners. It's called Uni Probe through the Uni app, where we basically test access to social media platforms, to websites, and whether or not they're blocked. And if they're blocked, what kind of blocking is being implemented in the country.
So it's a lot about information freedom and also, as you said, blocking websites, but as I see it, mostly websites of activists, like peace activists or people who try to make journalism more or less. Isn't that just part of a, you know, healthy democracy to do exactly that with the internet? And why is it blocked in Azerbaijan?
Well, you're right in that majority of the websites that are currently being blocked in Azerbaijan, they belong to independent and opposition media platforms. They've been blocked officially since 2017. This was part of one of the biggest sort of downgrades for Azerbaijan with regard to internet freedom when the Ministry of Communication, Transportation, and High Technologies decided that these platforms were not suitable in terms of the information that they were providing, as they were a danger to the national security of Azerbaijan, which is an explanation or an excuse used often by different governments across the world to limit access to these kind of websites and this kind of news information outlets. Today, a lot of these, not a lot, all of them that were blocked in 2017 remain blocked for access in the country. So they're mostly accessible via VPN services or through built-in bypass proxies within the applications of these platforms, mobile applications of these platforms that allow their audience to access the information, access these platforms. And if we look at other websites that have been blocked over time, I mean, we haven't heard of them in the news as we did in 2017, because back then the top five websites that were blocked were the top five websites that are known, were known for their independent reporting and for also their, whether they were partisan or they were opposition related and whatnot. But over time, we've seen how many other websites were blocked. Once again, mostly independent or affiliated with human rights defenders and journalists or former political prisoners, so to speak. And if we look at the type of attacks that happen or the target group of these attacks that come from the government, or at least the ones that we've discovered up until now. As you rightly noted, these are activists, these are rights defenders, journalists, and it's quite systematic. And especially in the context of the social media platform pages of these media outlets or journalists and whatnot, the attacks there are very clearly done with the purpose of preventing any further flow of information, because often when these pages are hacked, owners lose content, and not just from a couple months, but sometimes worth years of content. They also use a number of followers. All of a sudden they disappear, subscribers and whatnot. So the damage that is caused as a result of these attacks is quite big. And yes, often the target group are the civil society representatives, unfortunately.
Do you get any feedback about your work, or in the sense of does the government care?
Well, I don't think the government cares in a way to fix the problem, to improve the state of freedom of expression and the state of internet freedom in Azerbaijan. I do get feedback from users who are finding the information useful. I do get feedback from international organizations who find the information useful. But I think one personal takeaway from doing this project has been seeing how a lot of the targeted groups or individuals come to Azerbaijan Internet Watch to seek assistance, whether it is to recover their social media platform accounts or removing content that is, you know, clearly using a language of harassment or blackmail or humiliation and whatnot. You know, whether it's reporting a user or users on platforms like YouTube who do fake reporting to YouTube platform on the channels of these users, so copyright violations, and trying to work with social media platforms and restoring content and restoring videos and restoring channels. And I think that has been, it's been really concerning to watch just how much this has been taking place, like these small yet significant attacks. But also, you know, knowing that I can help is important to me personally. And I try to as much as I can.
Das war mein Gespräch mit Azuke Bulayeva. Wenn ihr mehr von ihr oder ihren Projekten erfahren wollt, dann findet ihr in den Shownotes Links zu ihrem Twitter-Profil, und dort teilt sie ihre aktuellen journalistischen Erkenntnisse, ihre Arbeit und Projekte und auch die ihres Netzwerkes. Wir hören uns dann am Freitag wieder. Bis dahin, macht's gut.
Eine Produktion von Haus 1.